Twin City Federal presents Minnesota Milestones, Ox Carts to Rockets, The Story of Transportation. This is Minnesota, Ox Carts to Rockets. The story of developing transportation in Minnesota of the past, transportation in the Minnesota of the distant future. I'm E.W. Zebarth, and with this program, Cedric Adams, Bob DeHaven, and I begin a series of 12 special hour-long broadcasts in honor of Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. The entire series we call Minnesota Milestones, each one covering a different phase of Minnesota's colorful, spectacular history, each one extending 100 years into the future. So listen now as we tell you the story of transportation, from the days of Minnesota as an unsettled wilderness, the story of the voyageurs, the explorers, the coming of the steamboats, the railroads, of Jim Hill, the empire builder, the poignancy of the horse and buggy era, the coming of the automobile, the airplane, the jet age, rockets and missiles. This is the story of you, of your fathers and your sons, the story of a wilderness that grew to greatness, the story of a series of Minnesota milestones. Minnesota, Ox Carts to Rockets. Beyond the hill is another hill, then a mountain, a plain, a desert, a broad sea. And man wandering, inquisitive, man always seeking, must explore and search for new lands. First, there was the Indian in the land we now call Minnesota. From whence he came, no man knows. But who was the first visitor to these hills and plains and woodlands and sparkling lakes? Some say it was the Vikings, sails flying over their ships lined with shields. Some say they sailed over larger bodies of water long since vanished. Some say they left a stone, the runestone it's called. Such a stone was found in Minnesota, a stone that tells the story of a voyage, translating its runic characters.
We are 8 Swedes and 22 Norwegians on an exploring expedition from Vinland West. We camped overnight by two skerries a day's journey north from this stone. We were fishing one day. After we came home, we found 10 men red with blood and dead. Ave Maria, save us from evil. Have 10 men by the ocean to look after our ships. 14 days' journey from this island. Year 1362.
Is it real? Were the Norsemen the first white men to see this land 600 years ago? We cannot be sure, but let's move on in time. When the voyageurs paddled their canoes of birch bark, gliding along the rivers and the lakes, paddling along the waterways of Minnesota, they came up the Mississippi and the St. Croix. From the St. Lawrence Great Lakes Superior Waterway they came, and they came from the Red River of the North. Radisson, Marquette, and Father Hennepin, Duluth and Le Sueur, La Vérendrye, Carver and Thompson, Pike and Schoolcraft. They were the explorers. The men who did the work was the voyageur, tough, hardy, French-Canadian or half-breed canoeman, excitable, dirty, profane, noisy, forever singing, forever talking, of quick delight and volatile anger. They brought their canoes over the highways of water and took out cargoes of furs, hides of mink, the otter, the beaver, and the muskrat. Before 1800, there came the keelboat, a sturdy craft 40 to 80 feet long and 8 to 10 feet wide. Zebulon Pike, I think he was a colonel, is that right, Bob DeHaven?
Yes, Zebulon Pike, explorer, army colonel, arrived in one of those keelboats at the place where the Minnesota River flows into the Mississippi back in 1805. And there, for $200 worth of presents and 60 gallons of whiskey, Pike bought from the Sioux the land on which Fort Snelling now stands. The keelboat man of the day was a boaster, a braggart, a rowdy, a rough and tumble fighter, a drinker bold and brave. The king of the keelboatmen, history tells us, was Mike Fink. His challenge for all men to hear was flung out at every stopping place.
I'm Mike Fink, king of the keelboatmen. I can outrun, outjump, throw down, drag out, and lick any man in the country. I'm a salt river roarer, a ringtail screamer. I love the women and I'm chock full of fight.
And many is the time that residents of a little village called Pig's Eye, better known today as beautiful St. Paul, many is the time they had their fill of the Mike Finks.
There came a date to remember, one of Minnesota's milestones, the 10th of May, 1823, and the guns boomed at Fort Snelling. It was a welcome for the steamboat Virginia, the first steamboat to arrive in the new land of Minnesota. The men of the fort, the white squatters, and all the Indians were there, and down they went, down the bluff to the landing to meet. History records that when the engineer blew the excess steam from the boiler, the Indians took to the woods. Men, women, and children with blankets flying in the wind, crying out in fear. While on the deck of the Virginia...
Look at their heathens run!
That was the beginning of the steamboat era. Not a spectacular start, really, for the Virginia was a sorry craft. 118 feet long, 19 feet wide, a sad little sternwheeler with a small cabin on deck. No pilot house, no mast, no figurehead, no gilt. None of the plush and the elegance that would come later. But the Virginia carried on her small deck several settlers, courageous, God-fearing, hardworking, ready to make their homes in the Minnesota wilderness. And there were more steamers and more settlers enduring hardship, filth. There were no cabins or fancy beds, not for settlers. They slept on the deck in rain or cold or burning July heat, enduring mosquitoes, dying of fever. Sometimes the hastily and poorly built steamboats blew up with a roar. Sometimes a fire broke out on deck. Hundreds were killed. But still, they came to this new promised land. And then there was the end of the journey at St. Paul, and that was a show for everyone, including the crowd that gathered as the steamer hove up to the levee. There was nothing fancy about the unloading. Cattle were prodded sharply, and each cow dumped over the gunwale into the water, was completely submerged for an instant, came up snorting, blowing, puffing, wild-eyed, and splashed straight for shore. In the 1840s, the trickle of steamboats grew to a flood, operating regular service between St. Paul and points down the river.
The steamboats did not penetrate deep inland on the small rivers, not at first. Each spring, when the prairie grass was long enough to furnish pasture for the plodding, head-dropping, sad-faced oxen, the Red River ox carts would begin their long trek overland from the settlements on the Red River of the North. They came loaded with furs, beaver, muskrat, mink, buffalo robes. And on the return trip, the second half of the summer, they carried salt, flour, household goods, all that settlers needed. And the trip was never a quiet one. There were sometimes 175 ox carts in the caravan. The driver shouted, the oxen trudged and plodded, and then there were the carts, made wholly of wood they were, wooden axles on wooden wheels, and the sound of screaming wood on screaming wood was deafening. And when the ox cart caravan passed a church on Sunday morning, the words of the pastor stood little chance against the ungodly screeching of the cart.
And brothers and sisters, as we come here to worship this morning, let me implore you to remember me.
The Red River ox carts use three main trails, and even now across pastures and through woodlands, you may see in places grassed over with time the deeply rutted grooves carved in the soil by the ox carts. One ox cart trail followed the Red and Minnesota rivers to Mendota. There was the East Plains Trail crossing the Red River at Pembina, downriver, turning east to Fergus Falls, following along what is now Highway 52 to St. Cloud, following the east bank of the Mississippi to Mendota. The third oxcart trail turned east at Breckenridge to the spot where the Crow Wing flows into the Mississippi and along the river's east bank to Mendota. The St. Cloud-Fergus Falls Trail was most heavily used. It was shorter and took the caravans north of the country of the marauding Sioux. The Red River cart trade came to an end completely during the Sioux outbreak in 1862, and by the time the Indians were conquered, the St. Paul and Pacific Railroad tracks were reaching out across the ox cart trails. So, another colorful Minnesota milestone, the era of the Red River ox carts, came to an end. You think the stagecoach was something that belongs to the old Wild West? Minnesota had its stagecoach era. Two and sometimes four horses pulling a creaking, swaying, rattling, jouncing conveyance. And like everything else, the stagecoach came in answer to a need. A need for transportation in the winter, when the rivers were frozen. Transportation to settlements where steamers could not go. An ad in the territorial newspapers, prepared by Willoughby and Powers in 1853, promised great things for the stagecoach traveler.
The public may rest assured that the proprietors have none but the best of teams, accompanied by careful drivers, and that they devote their utmost energies to ensure comfort and safety on all occasions.
Comfort? What comfort on a stagecoach? Those few pioneers still alive, those who rode on them, will tell you.
I tell you, oh, my back. I tell you, this dust, that bird will kill me.
There was no Vista Dome diner on the stagecoach. The food the passenger received at the way station was no pleasanter than the road he traveled. The noon stop was best. Then the stagecoach traveler enjoyed bacon, baked potato, biscuits, and tea, for which the traveler was expected to pay $1.50, quite a sum in those early days. But if the stage were late, if night had fallen, if the way station were small, then, well, it was like this.
Colonel, now there was a real ride. Every blasted bone in my blasted body feels like a toothache.
Well, I hope there's food in this pest hold. Doesn't look too promising, does it?
I'd say, matter of fact, it looks downright discouraging.
But by the 1860s, there were stagecoach lines reaching to nearly every community in Minnesota, regardless of dust, mud, jouncing, late schedules, and poor food. And at last, when the railroad spread across the land in the 1870s and 1880s, the stagecoach lines dwindled and died.
Yes, the Red River ox carts were important. The stagecoach was important. But the 1850s and 60s were the golden era of the steamboat. In 1850, there were only a few more than 6,000 people in Minnesota. 10 years later, the population had increased to 170,000. And the gain? It was due chiefly to the now large sternwheelers and sidewheelers that crowded the St. Paul levee every day during the navigation season. As late as 1853, St. Paul was only a small town, St. Anthony, but a village. But by 1860, both towns had doubled, tripled, and then quadrupled in size. Frequently, there were as many as 20 steamboats lined up at the St. Paul levee at the same time. And a St. Paul editor wrote in 1854,
"We predicted there would be a great increase in the business of this city, as well as an unprecedented immigration to the territory at the opening of navigation this spring. But we will candidly admit that we did not expect so perfect a rush as has set in upon us. Every boat comes crowded with freight and passengers. Storage on the levee is double what it was at this time last year. And new warehouses are building."
And in 1860, in the spring, before the navigation season opened, it was estimated that there were 200,000 bushels of grain stored, awaiting shipment to La Crosse, where the railroad from Chicago already reached the river. And the steamers, smaller ones, plied the rivers up the Minnesota to New Ulm, as far as Redwood Falls, up the Mississippi above St. Anthony Falls, along the St. Croix. And one vessel, the Anson Northrop, was dismantled, carried piece by piece along the Red River Oxcart Trail, was reassembled and put into service on the Red River of the North. Then, in September 1861, another Minnesota milestone. The steamer Alhambra tied up at the St. Paul levee. On a barge was a new kind of engine, the first in Minnesota, the William Crooks. It was ironic, perhaps, that a steamboat should bring upriver the first railroad engine, the iron horse that would shortly put it out of business. But having arrived, there was nothing for the Crooks to do. The rails were not yet laid, and there were no cars for it to pull. But the following spring, the coaches arrived on barges from downriver, and on June 28, 1862, the William Crooks was hitched to its garishly painted coaches and made the first railroad journey in Minnesota. Round trip from St. Paul to St. Anthony, now Minneapolis. Governor Edmund Rice was there, Lieutenant Governor Ignatius Donnelly, the mayors of St. Paul and St. Anthony. The chuffing engine stampeded the ponies of the Indians who had gathered along the new rail line to see their first iron horse. On July 2, 1862, the William Crooks began regular service. Four trips a day each way. The fare, 60 cents. But it was back in the 1840s that public clamor arose for railroads in Minnesota, the clamor coming from farmers, among others. Farmers objected to hauling their wheat by ox cart to the nearest river terminal, 100 miles or more. Before 1858, no one believed that Minnesota would ever amount to anything more than a raw wilderness. But in that year, it was suddenly driven home that Minnesota had become a wheat-exporting state, one of the nation's big wheat producers. And the public clamor for railroads grew louder and louder. So no wonder then that the William Crooks was greeted with such enthusiasm when it made its first appearance in the spring of 1862. And now railroad buildings spurted, thin ribbons of steel stretching across the land with amazing speed. One year later, there were 46 miles of railroad in Minnesota. 2 years later, 210 miles of track. By 1867, Minnesota was connected directly to Chicago. By the end of 1872, 15 railway companies had constructed almost 2,000 miles of railroad in the state. By 1880, Minnesota's basic railroad system, as we know it today, had been completed. There remained only the task of constructing feeder lines. Minnesota was covered by a network of 3,100 miles of railroad reaching into nearly every town. Settlers came by the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Minnesota's population had grown to 780,000 by 1880. The golden age of the railroads in Minnesota had begun.
And now, James J. Hill. His name is the name that towers above the Minnesota transportation story like Pike's Peak. James J. Hill, the man who is both loved and hated, sainted and feared. James J. Hill, the man who created a productive country, not only from a wilderness in Minnesota, but from a wilderness that extended all the way to the Pacific Ocean. James J. Hill, a hardworking man, a Canadian who came to Minnesota to the raw frontier. He sold one of Minnesota's first threshing machines, handled the first shipment of Minnesota-grown wheat. In his job as a shipping clerk, he cut a stencil for the label on the first barrel of Minnesota milled flour. James J. Hill obtained control of the bankrupt St. Paul and Pacific Railroad in the year 1878 and reorganized it as the St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Manitoba. He pushed out his railroad lines and then brought in the farmers to settle on his lands. He built towns, encouraged agriculture, improved livestock. James J. Hill's money went to libraries and to churches. And though a Protestant, he gave $1 million to build a Catholic seminary. James Jerome Hill, referred to as the Empire Builder, was called other names too. He was variously known as the man who made the Northwest, the man who wrecked the Northwest, the scourge of Minnesota and the Dakotas, the curse of Montana. Homesteaders brought to Minnesota on Jim Hill's railroad with Hill's money named a particularly offensive weed Jim Hill Mustard. The settlers in the Red River Valley had a saying that went, After the Grasshoppers, we had Jim Hill. And then in 1883, another mighty milestone in the history of Minnesota. The Northern Pacific Railroad became the second railroad to reach the Pacific Ocean. And such rejoicing. St. Paul was decked out as it never has been decked out before or since. The streets were covered with elaborate arches, making it look more like the Arabian Nights than a town known as Pig's Eye. On Wabashaw Street, there was an arch with a good-sized Chinese pagoda atop it. A banner proclaimed the Northern Pacific was the connecting link between St. Paul and China. Accounts of the day tell us there were blushing maidens strewing the streets with flowers. And in a 70-degree temperature that September 3rd, a 15-mile-long parade wound through St. Paul. It took 5 hours to pass any given point, had 725 decorated wagons, and 4,300 participants. That afternoon, four special trains came chugging into St. Paul from the west. Aboard were President Chester A. Arthur, former President Grant, cabinet members, governors, senators, ambassadors, congressmen, state officials, mayors, railroad officials, plus even a delegation of Indians. That evening, there was a banquet in the luxurious Hotel Lafayette on Lake Minnetonka. Mayor C.D. O'Brien of St. Paul arose.
Gentlemen, our banquet has been unexpectedly graced by the presence of His Excellency, the President of the United States. I have the honor to propose the health of President Arthur, the President of the United States, to be drank standing.
Mr. Mayor and gentlemen,
I thank you cordially for your kind greeting. I am glad to take part with you in these festivities. The great work, the accomplishment of which they seek to commemorate, may well be celebrated with joy and thanksgiving. And Mr. Mayor, well may your beautiful and thriving city and her sister municipality, standing as they do at the gateway of this new high road of commerce which stretches far out to sea, congratulate themselves that they enter today upon a career of enlarged usefulness and prosperity.
There was more talk from the president, and then lengthy speeches that went far, far into the small morning hours before the historic occasion was ended. The Great Northern pushed its tracks to the Pacific in 1893, and the Milwaukee Road reached the Pacific in 1909. Then in 1912, James J. Hill retired as chairman of the board of one of the world's greatest railroad empires. On that occasion, he said,
"Nearly 40 years ago, the thought of a possible railway enterprise in the Northwest began to occupy my mind. It was born of experience in Northwestern transportation problems that had occupied most of my early business life, of faith in the productive powers and material resources of this part of the country, and of the railroad conditions at that time. After long and close study of the situation, the slender beginnings were made on which we risked our all. Failures would be immediate and final disaster. Most men who have really lived have had, in some shape, their great adventure. This railway is mine."
His wealth still contributes to the educational and cultural benefit of Minnesotans through the Hill Family Foundation. The railroad era continued after James J. Hill's death in 1916, and with Minnesota's 9,000 miles of railroads constructed, efforts were turned toward improving service. Railroad developments in this century have included air conditioning, speedier schedules, improved couplers, brakes, shock absorbers, allowing trains to travel at higher speeds with greater safety, and to meet increasing competition in the automobile era and the air age. And we have seen the change from the steam locomotive to the diesel, the thrilling, spine-tingling hoot-hoot to the steam locomotive speeding through the countryside has been replaced by the modern sound of the diesel, the bleat of the compressed air horn, and the roar of powerful motors. Yes, Minnesota's railroads have spanned the most rapid development in all our state's history. In spite of the abuses in the railroad era, the land grabbing, the swindles, the tycoons of industry squeezing the small investor, in spite of these, railroads have built Minnesota, has spanned the period of the most amazing growth in the history of the world. Yes, the flanged wheel on the steel rail will continue to play an important part in the history of Minnesota. Friends, this is Cedric Adams. It's my pleasure to talk with you at this time on behalf of a native Minnesota institution under whose sponsorship we bring you these centennial broadcasts. Twin City Federal, as a nationally outstanding savings institution, as the Northwest's leading home financing institution, Twin City Federal has contributed much to the progress of our state. Its record of sound, steady growth is a reflection of family hopes realized, family dreams of home ownership made real. During this past year, for example, more than 8,000 Minnesota families enjoyed new happiness in homes of their own through financing made available at Twin City Federal. At the same time, savings increased more than $23 million, the largest increase recorded by any Northwest savings institution. Families from all over our state enjoy progress through saving at Twin City Federal, the $250 million savings institution. And you're cordially invited to join them, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature in downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul. Let's continue now with our story of transportation. Yes, there was the horse and buggy era. The old-timers still call it, with a tear of nostalgia, the good old days. Horses, horses, horses. Crazy over horses. That's the way the old song went. If we could go back there now, we'd think the folks were crazy over horses. But that's not the way it was, exactly. The horse was a way of life, like sleeping and eating and getting up in the morning. Like taking a bath on Saturday. The doctor came in a buckboard or a buggy, let the horse graze while he administered the backside slap that brought the young citizen into the world. The horse-drawn hearse carried the elderly citizen to his final resting place. And while the black-clad mourners dabbed their eyes, old Dobbin, with reins drooping and tail a-switching, nipped a few choice morsels for himself from the tall cemetery grass, with a few leaves from overhanging branches for dessert. And in between birth and death, the horse was not just a means of transportation. He was transportation. Most of what the maturing citizen ate was lugged home by the horse. The clothes on his back, the horse brought him from town. Buckboard in the summer, bobsled in the winter. To town and back, out around the farm. To the neighbors, off to Ma's and Pa's house. To town and back. Millions of hoof prints there in the dust, in the mud, and in the snow. It made no difference on the farm, in the country town, the county seat, the big city. It was the old hay burner who took you there. The hay burner that got you home again. The young man of yesterday was barely dry behind the ears when Pa took him in tow and taught him that necessary fact of life, all about hitching up the horse.
There, that's it, son. That's the martingale. Bring it up. No, no, no. Bring it under the belly. There, that's it. Now here, on the neck yoke. A hook to the britchen. Hey, you're doing fine, son. Fine. Hey, we'll make a teamster out of you yet.
And with the horse and buggy came that evil, that abomination. Many ladies still shudder at the word, the livery stable. Inevitably, our young citizen came home on a Saturday afternoon and ran right into the buzzsaw of Ma's wrath.
Ma, what did you hit me for?
You know what for. You've been down to that livery stable again, that's what for.
Ma, I weren't.
Yes, you were. Now, don't you lie to me, young'un. Mrs. Turner was just here and she seen you. I told you to keep away from that filthy place. When your Pa come home, I'm going to have him take the strop to you.
And Pa does come home and looks at Ma out of the corner of his eye. They've been all through this before, and he braces himself against the female blast of words that's cold as a winter's blast storm. Why is it she won't try to understand? He's tried to explain it. Everything she says is true. There is rough talk down at the livery stable, and some chewing and some cussing. The livery stable kept the horse and buggy era going. There, men talked about bloodlines and breeding. the foal out of such and such mare by such and such stallion. Ma hated and despised all that, but that's where her darling young'un went, right after he had growed up a little. Talk about hot rodders and drag racing. The young man of the 1800s and early 1900s was the long, sideburned young hoodlum of his day. He went to the livery stable and he picked out the highest, steppingest Morgan stallion he could find. He hitched it to the buggy with slender wheels, with spokes as fine as a girl's ankle. Its black and red gold finish he polished with loving care, and then off he went in a cloud of dust. The idea was to turn the corner on two wheels at breakneck speed, driving the horse to a fury. And if the margin of daylight between the tree on the corner and an elderly citizen just crossing the street, if that margin was growing ever narrower, that just made it all the more fun.
Dead burn, no good young whippersnapper.
And there he stood, the elderly citizen, covered with dust, waving his cane in frustrated anger, still frightened by the demon horse, galloping past his nose, the roaring wheels, and the wide-toothed grin of the young idiot on the buggy. But did the young idiot care about that? You bet your sweet life he didn't. He did it again as he rattled up the drive to his girl's house, wheels jouncing, bouncing, rattling, reined his horse and sprayed half a yard of gravel on the lawn. Oh, June, moon, croon, spoon. It's the lot of even the wildest of men, the young idiots too. Fate decrees they shall be tamed by women.
Honey, honey, bless your heart.
And there, as the silvery moon glints its light from the water, the young lover, an idiot no longer, the young lover turns and watches the light and the shadows on the face of his beloved. The breeze ruffles the trees and sighs gently. Old Dobbin droops his head sleepily, ears twitching as though he's trying to catch a soft spoken word. And they talk of many things.
But, Johnny, I don't know. I really don't. Dad says you're wild and, well, couldn't you try to act more, well, more like grown folks sometimes?
I guess I could. Something. What's wrong with having a little fun? Oh, I know. I guess your dad's right. All right.
Well, maybe if, just maybe, if I talk to Dad and then... Well, maybe if you talk to him, well,
you mean
maybe
what what I think you mean? Do you? That is, will you? Shall we?
Yes, Johnny.
Well, you know what happened after that. They sealed it with another kiss in the buggy, and then came at the little church... Then they were chivalried, and they got in the buggy and went on their honeymoon. Ah, honeymoon. They went to live with her folks until Johnny could settle down and find a job and start earning some money. And many a person still alive remembers this frantic scene. And the horse came tearing past at full gallop, foam at the mouth, eyes a-roll wildly, mane and tail flying in the breeze, buckboard bouncing, tipping crazily, swerving from this side to that. Dobbin either ran until he dropped from exhaustion or until one man, braver than the rest, dashed out, grabbed the reins, and, to the acclaim of the throng, dragged Dobbin down at last. The horse-drawn car came in the 1870s. Some towns had mule-drawn streetcars. There were steam-drawn trains in the streets of St. Paul and Minneapolis. And then in the 1890s came the electric streetcar. It gave old Dobbin a good run for his money in the bigger towns, and he rapidly lost his job. By the turn of the century, there were streetcars in Moorhead, St. Cloud, Mankato, Winona, and Breckenridge, while the network of rails lengthened in the ever-growing, ever-expanding areas of Minneapolis and St. Paul, clear out to White Bear. Do you remember the old Wildwood car, the one that went to Stillwater?
The other way, out west to Hopkins, out to Lake Minnetonka, where the streetcar boats plied the shimmering water in the summertime. And though the streetcar rattled through the streets and across the country, though it carried millions to their destinations, old Dobbin was still king. Horse and buggy, railroad train, and electric streetcar, a combination that would last 1,000 years or maybe more. So everybody believed. Oh, yes, a few of them thought that dad-blamed horseless carriage was just a starting to show here and there. But old Dobbin was still king. The buckboard, the buggy, the hay rack, the white-coated sweeper with his cart still swept and swept and swept, intent on his task. And the hoofbeat still clattered on the cobblestones. And also out along the rutted roads, the sound of galloping still heard down our country lanes. Few realized it then, but one of Minnesota's milestones, the horse and buggy era, was drawing to a close. A golden, glorious, wonderful era that will live long in the memory of men. I think anyone familiar with the history of Minnesota can't help being impressed with our people's record of thrift. And of course, it's natural that a hardy, vigorous people who believe in being self-sufficient should in turn be thrifty. For thrift, the practice of regular saving, is the surest way to self-sufficiency, to personal and family independence. Twin City Federal is proud to have had a part in helping Minnesota families achieve the security and happiness that go with sound, growing savings accounts. Thousands and thousands of Minnesota families choose to place their savings with Twin City Federal. And they do so for many reasons, of course. And one of them, surely, is safety. Accounts at Twin City Federal are insured for safety by the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, a permanent agency of the United States government. You're warmly invited to enjoy progress towards your personal and family independence. Progress through saving at Twin City Federal, a thoroughly safe place to save, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature in downtown St. Paul and Minneapolis. We continue with our story of transportation in Minnesota. Say, Dave, an old man, what's the first car you can remember?
Well, I'll tell you, Father Time. It was the Apperson Jackrabbit made in Kokomo, Indiana. It was purchased by my Uncle Tom, who lived in Anderson, Indiana, and this was back in 1915. It had a Jackrabbit emblem about 1 foot long on the radiator grill, and over the weekend, he'd jack it up 3 inches from the floor. That saved the tires, he used to say. And since you've made a point of making me bear my age right here before all these people, Cedric, I'd like to ask you the same question. What is the first car you remember?
Well, Robert, really there's no reason for you to be so sensitive about your old age. The first car I can remember was way back in 1905. A brush it was, a two-seater, painted a brilliant red. My father came home with it one day back in the old hometown of Magnolia. As I remember, it was a two-cylinder job with a double-chain drive. It made a terrific noise, not too powerful in the mud, but it was a sensation wherever it appeared among people and horses. Old Dobbin and the people who rode him and drove him and cleaned up after him didn't know it, but Dobbin was really a dead pigeon. Back there in the 1890s and the early 1900s, the horseless carriage began showing up, just a few at first. They clattered and they chugged and they rattled and they banged and they spit and they coughed and they backfired.
How do you like this car?
What did you say?
I said, isn't this car a hurry?
Oh, I'll bet it costs a lot of money.
No, not money, honey. Honey, isn't it? Oh, never mind.
As you can see, conversation was next to impossible. But in spite of all the noise, the gasoline buggy kept coming. By 1902, there were 11 cars in Minneapolis. And that same year, the age of reckless driving began.
Say, you, in the gasoline buggy.
Yes, sir?
Pull over to the curb.
Now, where do you think you're going at that breakneck pace?
But, officer, I was only doing 11 miles an hour.
If you were driving a horse as you should be, then you'd be after knowing the speed limit in this town is 10 miles per hour.
And that's how one Tom Shevlin, driving a French-made car, received the first traffic ticket and then paid a $10 fine for exceeding the speed limit in Minneapolis way back in 1902. That same summer, believe it or not, three men arrived in the Twin Cities by car from far-off Chicago, and they made it in the incredible time of 6 days. They bought stove fuel at 9 cents a gallon at general stores along the way.
And here's a little touch, Cedric. It was on May 30th, 1901, that Shakopee, Minnesota, saw its first horseless carriage. A bush it was. The whole town turned out en masse. Everybody, that is, except the village fathers. They were meeting that same day, refused to be disturbed over the newfangled and obviously short-lived contraption. They voted $150 to build a bicycle path to Bloomington.
And there blossomed, too, the age of goggles and linen dusters. For the men, of course, and for the women, hats of colossal width with veils to protect them from the dust and the wind of open car driving.
The early day motorist, remember, was hemmed in by rules on every side. Speed limits 5 to 10 miles per hour, noise restrictions, Sabbath restrictions, license troubles, and oddball traffic rules designed by police right on the spot.
Each operator of a motor vehicle, upon encountering a horse-drawn vehicle, shall come to a full and complete stop. An operator of aforesaid motor vehicle shall turn off motor of said motor vehicle until such time as aforesaid horse-drawn vehicle has passed from view.
There was even a law on the books which said that a car proceeding through a heavily populated area must be preceded by a man on foot waving a red flag.
Yes.
And you know, Bob, we even have some remnants of those laws today. We run into them every now and then. And here's the part we can remember, Robert. The get out and get under part. Old Tin Lizzy, old Leapin' Lena, just didn't want to leap sometimes. And that led to this little scene. Remember?
Hey, mister. You ain't having trouble with that there contraption, be ya? Be smart, mister. Get a horse. Ha, 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 ha. Eat up, Nellie.
And Cedric, remember all the tools you had to cart along in those days?
Yes, and even if you kept the gasoline buggy going, you were in trouble once you left your own community where you knew the roads. Here's a little sample published by the State Automobile Association back in 1911. Instructions on how to get from Owatonna to Dubuque. To get there, you did just exactly what the book said. From Owatonna, follow Owatonna Road to Pratt. From Pratt, follow the main traveled road to the Red Barn. Take the left fork along the old stage road. Keep on the road through Lansing to Austin. Turn in on the road marked by Hub Department Store sign to Rose Creek. Follow main road south to Frank. Go straight through Leroy to Chester, following the Milwaukee tracks to Bon Air to Cresco. Take the road turning right from Pratovin. Follow that 6.5 miles south, 4 miles east, 2 miles south, and 6 miles east to Lawler. Many of those roads are sandy and full of holes, so great care must be taken at this point as roads are intersected and forked and directions must be asked. You know, Robert, I don't think we can get there from here.
Impossible.
Yeah.
And by 1918, everybody knew it. Everybody except the old diehards, that is. The horse and buggy era was dead, gone forever. A world crumbled and fell into the dust. And then a new world arose. A bigger world, a gigantic world. Its symbols, speed and endless ribbons of concrete and asphalt.
Now, wait a minute there, Robert. We have the story of Charlie Babcock. Do you remember him?
The former highway commissioner?
Yes, that's the man. Charles M. Babcock. An Elk River storekeeper he was back in the early 1900s. Charlie Babcock was a good deal more visionary than most folks then. Besides, bad roads were hitting him where it hurt, right in his bank account. So Babcock campaigned for Sherburne County Commissioner.
And regardless of how they tell you, don't you believe them, my friends, when they tell you that the horseless carriage isn't here to stay. I foresee the day when every man, every family will own a motor car. Your vote for me for county commissioner in this election will be a vote for better roads, paved roads, all-weather roads from the farms into the town.
and Babcock won the election.
Oh, he certainly did. Then in 1917, the legislature made Babcock our first highway commissioner. When he left office in 1933, Minnesota had a 7,000-mile trunk highway system, 1,400 miles of paved secondary roads, 36,000 miles of graveled or surfaced roads. He initiated a highway numbering system, and during his administration, back in 1929, the Minnesota Highway Patrol was established. There, indeed, is a name you should remember, Charles M. Babcock, father of the Minnesota highway system. We're back now to 1914, the rattletrap era, and the scene is northern Minnesota, Hibbing. A diamond drill operator named Carl Wickman grew tired of his job in the mines, and a blacksmith's helper named Andrew Anderson became weary of lifting the sledge.
Oh, what a headache. Sometime I think my head split wide open. Clang, clang, clang. Hey, don't want no more clang, Carl. I like to mess around with these here motor car things.
I'll tell you something, Andy. Drilling ain't no prize either. That's what I want to talk to you about. Now, I got an idea. Why don't we go into the jitney business?
Jitney? What's jitney?
Well, it's a business, a sort of hauling business. A stagecoach using motor cars.
So, go into business they did. And from that beginning grew the giant of the nation. It's buses and scenic cruisers, familiar everywhere. Greyhound bus lines. Now, there are 12 bus lines operating in Minnesota with annual revenues exceeding $100 million. And right along with the buses came the equally huge trucking industry. Many of the largest firms today started after World War I as one-truck outfits, with the owner serving as driver, mechanic, salesman, and even office boy. Some, like Murphy Motor Freight, began even earlier as drayage lines. Hennepin Transportation Company was organized back in 1918, when a 50-mile trip was indeed a long haul. Glendenning Motorways was founded in 1924 by Gordon Glendenning, who was working his way through college. And this you may not know, may scarcely believe, but it's true. Today, more than 100 common carriers operate out of St. Paul and Minneapolis every day. And the Twin Cities area is the third largest truck terminal center in the entire United States. The grand total, 100,000 trucks in use by commercial firms. One-third of Minnesota's more than 2,000 communities are solely dependent on trucks for their freight hauling. A giant industry in the automobile era.
And now we face a new future in the motor age. A future so fast that no man 50 years ago could have envisioned the developments that are to come. The bulldozer, the grader, the heavy tractor sound. Detour signs will be thicker than bugs in fly time, but by 1975, a network of federal interstate freeways costing $732 million in Minnesota alone, a nonstop network of highways covering 890 miles in Minnesota, will reach north, south, east, and west. And this is the freeway era, the high-speed era, the step-on-it-and-get-there era. Its trademark will be twin ribbons of pavement carving wide gaps through the cities, stretching across our farmlands, through forests, to our lakes and beyond, across or rolling under 1,000 bridges. These are the superways that will serve a vast Twin Cities metropolitan complex of the future, stretching unbroken from the St. Croix to Minnetonka, from Rosemont to Forest Lake, one huge city. They will bring farm and city ever closer, the small town scarcely more than around the corner, the lake to your very front door. 20 million people, 10 million cars and trucks and buses. There's your future the next 100 years. Minnesota, 2058.
The history of a state or a community is nothing more or less than a record of people's hopes and dreams, and whether or not they attain them. And any history will show that hopes and dreams never get very far unless they're combined with some kind of action. If we narrow that truth down to our own personal lives, I think we can agree that thrift is a perfect form of action to bring personal hopes and dreams to fulfillment. Yes, for the home you may want, for the new car you may want, for your youngster's education, for business opportunity, for a retirement fund, for security. Start saving and save regularly at Twin City Federal. The current dividend rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly, and that is the top rate in town on insured savings. And you can benefit by this top rate wherever you may live. People from all over our whole area do so by saving by mail at Twin City Federal. For full information, write to me, Cedric Adams, here at WCCO, St. Paul or Minneapolis. Simply ask for details of Twin City Federal's Save by Mail plan. And friends, do it soon, will you? And now our transportation story enters the air age.
One day it came, the funny, frail, single-motored biplane zooming low over the county fairgrounds. The dawn of the air age. And they did barrel rolls and loops and outside loops, these men who had no thought for paid-up insurance. And on the grounds, the crowds gawked and owed and awed in wonder. Yes, Minnesota became aware of the airplane in World War I. Some of its sons were aviators in the famed Lafayette Escadrille over there in France. The planes showed up in the skies in the early 20s here in Minnesota. The favorite stunt, diving with a zooming, heart-stopping roar under the high bridge in St. Paul. Charles Speed Holman did that and more. He barnstormed around the countryside, thrilling the customers at the county fairs, flying upside down before the grandstand a few hundred feet off the ground. And that's how, in 1931, his Laird biplane Roaring, one of Minnesota's air pioneers, met his untimely end. And who ever heard of Charles Augustus Lindbergh? A tall, lanky kid with a wide, wide grin. He grew up at Little Falls here in Minnesota, in the shadow of his politician father. Until the 21st of May, 1927, when Lindy captured the imagination of the world with his first solo, nonstop flight across the Atlantic, from New York to Paris, and the world went mad with joy. Oh, yes, there were skeptics.
Flying machines. I tell you, if the good Lord had intended us to fly, he'd have given us wings. Yes, sir.
But the intrepid young men went right ahead with their flying machines. Two of them rented a couple of planes, brazenly dubbed themselves Northwest Airways, and away they went into the wild blue yonder back in 1926. And there came a young man, son of a Fargo merchant. Croyle Hunter was no flyer. A businessman he was. But he teamed with flyers, and together they dreamed and saw the future up there in the skies. They reorganized as Northwest Airlines. They bought three Ford Tri-Motors, the famous Tin Goose. And how was business? Oh, there were ups and downs, but business was great. And still, it was pioneering. And Northwest Airlines pushed out to the Pacific Coast in December 1933 and got there without the 10,000 laborers, the thousands of miles of rails, the sweat, the labor, and all of Jim Hill's millions. Carl Hunter became president and general manager of Northwest Airlines in 1937. And the planes changed from the cough and sputter to the steady drone of the DC-3, the first modern airliner, the workhorse of the airlines. Yes, the air age had arrived. And if anyone had any doubt, World War II erased that doubt forever. Northwest Airlines flew to Alaska for the Air Transport Command. And out of that experience came more expansion. To New York in 1945, to the Orient a year later. And now the Twin Cities and Minnesota, the link in a chain around the world in 1958. Looming ahead is the jet age. As Northwest Airlines President Donald Nyrup likes to say, the old Ford Tri-Motors cost us $85,000 apiece. The new jets will cost $5 million, and they don't even give us a pair of pliers. Northwest, Capital, North Central, Braniff, Western, Ozark, all serving the Twin Cities in Minnesota. New and expanding, a new Old Chamberlain Field, new terminal, new airline facilities. $54 million worth of newness in the air age, expansion without limit. Now there are new sounds, strange new sounds. And what's in the future? Is this too fantastic? Too visionary?
Your attention, please. Northwest Airlines Super Rocket, Flight 832 for Cairo, with intermediate stops at Bombay and Calcutta. Now loading gate 25.
What is the limit of man's thirst for travel to see what is beyond and beyond that? Where will the power of the atom take us, at how many millions of miles an hour, and how far into space? Who can say the solar systems man may one day visit, trillions of miles in God-created space? The voyageur in his birch bark, paddling the forested rivers, the ox cart man driving his beasts over dusty trails, the steamboatman, the railroader, even the great James Jerome Hill would stand amazed. Could they but stand where we stand? And Minnesota's future is there in the next 100 years.